The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Taxes Committee to order. And out of respect for those that actually show up on time, and I thank members for that, we're going to get started. And the riveting testimony we're about to have, those members that are not here will just have to miss it. That's the way it is. Sometimes you just have to live with disappointment. So with that, welcome to the committee. I will move when we have a quorum, House File 2690. And for today, members, this will be not voted on today. It will be laid over for another committee meeting. So with that, we're very pleased today to have with us from the Department of Revenue, Ms. Von Mosch. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record and present the House File 2690. Members, this is what we would normally call a technical bill, a department bill, but it's very important that we see what the department is looking at here and what we want to move forward with. So, Ms. Von Mosch, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Susan Von Mosch with the Department of Revenue. Thank you for being the primary author, the author of the bill that we're hearing today, House File 2690. It is the department's technical bill. And earlier this summer, the department kicked off our annual development of our policy and technical bills by encouraging all of the department professionals at all levels to bring forth ideas for improving how we administer the tax code. This bill and the bill you're hearing tomorrow on tax policy really came up through the ranks within the agency. We winnowed them down. We started out, I believe, with 270 different proposals, and they were winnowed down pretty significantly during the process. The recommendations before you today range from general housekeeping and technical changes like correcting cross-references and repealing obsolete language. We tried to promote efficiency and streamline processes, and we tried to look at items that are we consider to be taxpayer-friendly, like clarifying different requirements that we have in the tax code. Typically, what we do is we have the professionals, the attorneys from appeals and legal, walk through the bills, and so they will introduce themselves when they come up. I'll give you a quick overview right now. We'll review the bill by article. So the first article on individual income and corporate taxes will be Jenny Ryan. Article 2 on estate taxes will also be Jenny Ryan. Then Lance Stricka will talk about Article 3 on property taxes and sales and special taxes. Article 5 will be Steve Krinkle with minerals. And Cecilia Morrow on Article 6, which is miscellaneous. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. And as we get started here, if I could just ask folks in the audience if there's anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns on this bill. Okay, we'll go section by section with that question. So if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Jenny Ryan. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'll be beginning with Article 1.
Starting Welcome with to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sections 1, 8, and 9 begin by moving the definition of a field audit to the definition section of Chapter 289A, which is where definitions are generally found, and clarifies that a field audit is completed at the later of an order of assessment or notification from the department that no change to the taxpayer's return will be made. Field audit has been a defined term since about 1991. And since then, it has involved an audit that includes the physical presence of auditors at a taxpayer's place of business. While some of the audit takes place at the taxpayer's place of business, much of the work of reading the documents that are produced and researching the laws that apply to determine the correct amount of tax takes place at the auditor's desk at the department. This is opposed to what the department refers to as an office audit, which is something that's conducted entirely from the auditor's desk. The field audit, as I said, ends with an order of assessment or a letter to the taxpayer letting them know that no changes are forthcoming. If a field audit is completed and then afterwards a federal tax change occurs, the department may only make additional changes to the taxpayer's return that relate to those federal change items. Some taxpayers are currently in administrative appeals arguing that a field audit and as soon as the department's auditor physically leaves the taxpayer's place of business. Since 1991, this has not been the department's practice, nor its understanding or interpretation of current law. Sections 1, 8, and 9 clarify the department's longstanding practice and understanding of current laws. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 make technical changes to the estimated tax payment provisions found in Section 289A26, which apply to both C corporations and entities that pay unrelated business income tax. We've noticed that the term corporation and entities are used interchangeably throughout these sections. And this proposal clarifies that in these instances, the statute means both C corporations and entities that pay unrelated business income tax. Sections 6, 7, 8, and 10 are all related to provisions regarding to the requirement that taxpayers report federal tax change items to the department. In sum, these provisions clarify the following. First, that a taxpayer is required to report to the commissioner within 180 days of a federal tax change. Second, the taxpayers who do not report within the 180-day period are subject to a 10% penalty of the amount of any underpayment of Minnesota tax attributable to that federal change. Third, that the department can reassess the tax, including a refund, within the shorter of 6 years after the report should have been filed, or 1 year after a taxpayer follows the report, notwithstanding any general statute of limitations to the contrary. And finally, as I said earlier, if the department has completed a field audit prior to the federal change, then those department changes are limited to those necessarily flowing from the federal tax change items. Sections 11 and 15 deal with a federal possessions tax credit under Internal Revenue Code Section 936, which is no longer operable for tax years after December 31st, 2011. So this proposal repeals obsolete references to the Internal Revenue Code. Sections 12, 13, and 14 also repeal obsolete modifications for federal extraterritorial income while also amending impacted cross-references. Section 16 involves net operating losses. Businesses have either apportioned business income or assigned non-business income or both. The same is true for losses. Losses generated from the conduct of a trade or business are apportioned, while losses generated from non-business income are assigned. This proposal makes it clear that the net operating loss reflects both Minnesota apportioned business losses and Minnesota assigned non-business losses. And Section 17 deals with unity and combined reporting requirements and clarifies that for combined reporting, unity of ownership does not exist when two or more corporations are involved unless there is directly or indirectly a common owner of more than 50%. The statute, while applying to entities with voting stock, meaning corporations, uses the phrases business entity and corporation interchangeably. This is a point of confusion and disagreement for a few taxpayers, including some administrative appeal issues and a case in tax court. This amendment clarifies the department's longstanding interpretation of Section 290.17, Subdivision 4, that the more than 50% common owner test is applied only to related corporations. I'll move on to Article 2 regarding the estate tax.
Okay, before we do that, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify regarding Article 1 that Ms. Ryan has just presented? We do have a couple of folks that would be interested in that. You can state your name and who you represent, please, for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. We just want to draw your attention to two provisions in Article 1. First, Section 1, the definition of field audit. We certainly support the department's moving the definition into this area of the law. The concern we have is on line 2.0, the sentence on beginning on line 2.2 to ending on 2.4. Some of the tax practitioners that we deal with think that that will allow the department to keep state tax returns open. If they, for example, if you find out if a corporation is under federal audit, and federal audits can be open for decades at times. The concern from the taxpayer point of view is that if you don't say once you've completed a field audit that the Minnesota issues will be closed out at a certain point in time, you know, their state issues could be open as well for, you know, for that extended period as long as they're under federal audit. So
Mr. Hesse, are you saying that by that language you could have a situation where you would just never close out an audit?
Until if they find out that you're under federal audit, it would be open until the federal audit closes. And that could be an extended period of time where, at least in our members' point of view, it should be a much more limited time frame.
Okay. Before you continue, Mr. Hesse, I will officially call the meeting to order. The tax committee, we have a quorum. Representative Bisgins moves the minutes of March 16th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all fair say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bisgins. Okay, so I will officially move House File 2690 so that it's officially before us. And members, the plan for today is to go through each article with the department. This is the department technical bill. And we will go through articles 1 through 6. And we will go through each article and then open it up for questions with people that support or have concerns after each article. So, Mr. Hesse, you have the floor, please, and I apologize for interrupting there.
Sure, and maybe this will make it a little easier to understand. So the sentence, you know, the field audit is complete at the later of an order issued or notification that no change will be made. Our concern is that the department could not issue an order or notify the taxpayer that no change will be made, keep their state portion of their audit open, and you know, draw this process out a certain length of time. So that's concern number one. The second issue is on page 19 in section 16, and again the sentence beginning 19.31 to 19.32. We had a conversation with the department this morning and are trying to work through that so our members have the same understanding as the department does. So there is still some, I guess, unresolved issues from our members' point of view, but it's something that might be resolved with a phone call or two later today. So with that, I guess I'll just stop and be happy to answer any questions.
Members, are there any questions for Mr. Hesse? Ms. Larson, would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I just want to echo Mr. Hesse's comments. We also have the same concerns expressed in those two sections. And I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay, if the department could come back and continue with testimony.
Members of the committee, again, I'm Jenny Ryan.
Madam.
May I stop you just for a moment? I guess there were some questions previously. Representative Depke, would you go ahead with your question, please?
Thank you very much. Actually, this is a question to the department, and it's a general question, actually, and it has to do with audits in general, and I don't know whether it has to do with this particular section of the bill, but when I was having meetings this fall with my Chambers of Commerce and small businesses in my district, I think the audit process came up way more often than any other single issue for my small businesses. And I have a couple of examples that concern me deeply about the process that we currently have. The first one was a funeral home owner. He and his family run the funeral home in my district. He doesn't have a lot of people working for him, and he needs to be there at all times, most of the time, or his family. He was audited, and he was audited, and the auditor was in his office for 5 months, At the end of 5 months, there was a $500 discrepancy that obviously he was obliged to pay and paid. And but the question that I have is, it seems to me that 5 months is a tremendously long time, and I would like to know what kind of return on investment we got on that kind of audit for 5 months in order to capture $500. The other thing is another small business that I had, who is a sole owner of the business with two people. The auditor was in her business for 3 days. At the end of the audit, he gave her a form to fill out and sign that he found no discrepancies and left. Less than a week later, she got a call from the auditor that he had given her the wrong form to sign, and she said, okay, fine, that's all right, I'm booked today. He asked her if she was available. She said, no, I've got meetings all day, so why don't you just, you know, scan another document, I'll sign it, and I'll get back to you, or you can fax it to me, and I'll fax you back with my signature. The answer was, no, we do not have the capability to do that. It's against our rules, and he was a total round trip of 3 hours away. She had to wait in the office. She had to cancel her meetings. He came back. She signed the form. He left, but it would be interesting to me that why we had to, as a state, pay for three more hours of this particular person's, salary in order, because he made a mistake and it penalized my small business. So I have a couple of questions on the audit that I think are important for your department to respond to. And if you want to get back to me, that's fine.
Ms. Ryan?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry that your constituents were having a hard time. Certainly, the department's expectations of its audit procedures is that it's not difficult for taxpayers and it's not overtaxing on their time and effort. So I'm sorry that to hear that in these two instances we didn't meet those expectations. I can tell you that I have looked into this question about a field audit and how long does a field audit take, how long does the department normally take to complete a field audit. And I can say that for big corporations, looking at a two-year period, it looks like 70% of corporate field audits are completed within a year's time. Now, certainly that does not mean that the department is in the taxpayer's place of business for the entire duration of that year. In fact, it's normally our practice to only be at the taxpayer's place of business for the time necessary to collect the documents and to otherwise do our work within our own offices at our own desks. I can tell you that for pass-through entities, so possibly smaller businesses, that those audits are completed within a year about 87% of the time. And when I asked around to auditors to find out why a field audit might take longer than a year, I learned that sometimes taxpayers ask for an extension of a statute of limitation period to give the taxpayer and the auditor time to reach a settled agreement so that nobody expends time and energy in an administrative or tax court appeal process. I know in some instances, auditors are making monthly contact with taxpayers but aren't receiving any contact in return. Some taxpayers ask for extensions of a statute of limitations period because they're also working with the IRS on the same periods of time, and they request to work with the IRS first and then with a second to minimize the burden on the business. So I certainly apologize again for the experience your constituents have.
Representative Depke.
Well, thank you. I'm not really completely satisfied with that answer because these were specific instances, and I could name about three or four more. I would like it if you could have give me someone within the Department of Revenue that my constituents can contact to give them to testify to the way they were treated during the audit and to answer your questions. I'm certainly open that if in any way my constituents are at fault, then I think that would be interesting to know that. But I know them quite well, and I have every reason to believe that some of the things, you just don't have that many people in a setting that are unhappy with a single, you know, piece of this, and it seemed to me that it took an unusual amount of time, but we can certainly investigate it further, get to the bottom of it. But if you could please contact my office with someone that my constituents can come to and talk to about it and give you the specifics of their problem, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Van Moss?
Madam Chair, Representative Demke, we do have certain restrictions within the environment that we're in today in terms of what we can say about individual audit cases, and I'm not familiar with the situations you're referring to, but we will follow up with you and set up a meeting with the person who is in charge of the audit process, and we will follow up so that we can try to get behind what's going on with some of these situations.
Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the department as well. I can echo the same stories that Representative Depke had shared with you just now, and it brings to mind that this seems to be a common problem, that it's not an outlier. And so I'm just wondering, what kind of procedures do you have to review your audit situation? What kind of anonymous input do you provide to individuals to comment about your audit process? I had one individual that said, I don't want you to do anything because I fear retribution. So I'm just curious, what kind of opportunities do you give individuals who have been audited to provide their input and feedback on that process?
To the testifiers.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can tell you that what I know is the Corporate Franchise Tax Division, for example, did for a number of years conduct audit quality surveys with taxpayers. The last survey that I saw was from fiscal year 2008, and the response was overwhelmingly positive about taxpayers' experience under audit with the Corporate Franchise Tax Division. I can also add that certainly the department has a taxpayer rights advocate who receives calls with concerns from taxpayers and works as a liaison to ensure that divisions are receiving the feedback they need to correct any errors or missteps in the audit process.
Representative Anderson, do you have a follow-up?
Sure. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I'm glad you have that from 2008. I would recommend that you maybe review that again and also expanded beyond just that scope, because I think that there's a lot of folks out there that are very frustrated by the process. Getting through to talk to individuals is another issue as well. And I think it's always helpful to review on an annual basis your process and have somebody from outside look in to see, you know, are you actually providing a service here, or are you making it actually more difficult for people to comply with the laws that we have in the state? And I'm guessing it's your goal that you want them to comply, but, you know, we should make that as easy as possible to help them through that process.
Madam Chair, Representative, and all members of the committee, we are voluntary compliance is one of the department's primary goals, and we are working all the time with the audit process. We do hear complaints ourselves about the audit process, and we are working at trying to make things more efficient all the time. So this kind of feedback, we will take it back to the department, we will talk with the right people, and we will continue to look into it, I can assure you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Van Moss. Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question of the testifiers. On page 6, line 13, is that recomputation new authority?
To the testifiers.
Madam Chair, Representative, the question is about line 6.13. But I'm sorry, I didn't hear the rest of the question.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it is. And the question is the authority to recompute the tax. Is that new authority, or is this just authority that's being moved around from another section of statute?
Ms. Ryan.
Chair, Representative, this is current authority. It's just being moved to make the provisions clearer.
Representative Downey. Representative Downey stepped out. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to Representative Dupke's question. I don't think he answered her second question about why something couldn't be faxed. You know, we're in the electronic age. I conduct all kinds of business, and I'm sure every member of this committee does, where we file things through email or fax things. I mean, it's the way business is done today. So what prohibits the department from doing that? And if it took that amount of time to drive out and pick up a document, if you can't use the electronic tools that are available today, what was wrong with the U.S. mail?
Ms. Ryan?
Madam Chair, Ms. Representative Penn. Carlson, I don't know the answer to that question. I will have to go and check and get back to you on that. I'm not totally aware of all of the audit procedures or exactly what they have to follow, so we'll have to check and get back to you on that.
And Madam Chair, you know, we can file our tax returns electronically. I mean, we can do a lot of things with the department. All of us not too long ago completed our campaign finance reports, and they prefer we do all of that electronically. I mean, there's just, you know, we're in the new century here. And maybe the department should look at some of that. And if it's required by law, maybe that's something that should be addressed here then. Or if it's a rule or regulation within the department, maybe you should take a look at that. But thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ryan, can we continue with Article 2, please?
Okay.
Ms. Ryan.
Madam Chair, moving on to Article 2, the estate taxes. All of Article 2 relates to the recapture tax, which is part of the estate tax exclusion that passed during the last special session regarding qualified small business and qualified farm property. The language that passed in the previous session included a provision in Chapter 291 that imposed a recapture tax payment due date of 6 months or 6 months after a disqualifying cessation of the business or disqualifying disposition of the property. While imposing this payment due date, the language that passed assumed a return would be required and a return filing due date. Now, those kinds of provisions are normally found in Chapter 289A. So here, Section 1 moves the return requirement to Section 289A10, moves the return filing due date to 289A18 in Section 3, and then in Sections 4, 5, and 6, moves that payment due date to Section 289A20. So we're just putting those administrative provisions where we normally find them. Section 2 proposes that there also be an annual information return requirement during that three-year period after the decedent's death. So part of the requirements is that the qualified heirs continue to operate the trader business and own the trader business for a three-year period after death. In that first year, we would receive the estate tax return itself, and we'd ask that there also be an informational return filed in years 2 and 3, which should just help us make sure that the requirements of the statute in terms of its use and not being disposed of would take place. That's Article 2.
All right. Are there anybody from the audience who would like to speak in favor or against this particular article? Are there any questions from the committee members? Okay, we will move on to Article 3 then. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Lance DeRica with the Department of Revenue. Starting with I'll be talking about Article 3 and 4. Article 3 is about property tax. As indicated in the summary, I'm first going to talk about sections 1, 5, 7, 8, and 12 of Article 3. Two main things are going on in those five sections. The first thing has to do with providing privacy and protection for certain income tax information that we required last year. Just briefly, last year was the first time we required applicants for the farm agricultural classification to submit an income tax form, the Schedule F that shows farm income, and we're adding a statement now to provide protection, privacy for that return. And necessary cross-references are being changed. Second thing going on is that we're eliminating some obsolete language related to mailing homestead applications. It used to be an annual process back in until the early 90s, and every year the assessor would mail out a homestead, the new annual homestead application, and if people didn't return it in 30 days, we'd send it to them again. This the 30 days language is still in there, and we're striking that. It's caused some confusion. And again, there are necessary cross-references being made. Sections 2 and 14 go together. Last year, there was a law change allowing counties to do land exchanges. And when they do the land exchange, the county authority statute says they can have the value of the land determined either by private appraisement or by the county assessor. The problem is that the county assessors have prohibitions on how much non-tax valuations they can do. So we are adding this authority for the county. We are following up the change in the county authorities that was made last year by allowing the county assessor, explicitly allowing the county assessors to do these valuations with this change.
Mr. Starica, I'm going to interrupt you just for a moment. We have a group of upcoming business leaders from the Minnesota High Tech Association ACE Leadership Program. Would you please stand and welcome to the committee. Thank you for visiting today. Mr. Starica, would you continue with your testimony, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Continuing with Article 3, Section 3 has to do with the air flight property tax, kind of a hybrid tax, and we are just clarifying that the Commissioner of Revenue can abate late payment penalties. And one more time, paired sections, Section 4 and 9 go together. Sections 4 and 9 have to do with property taxation for property that's initially exempt but then leased or otherwise made available to a taxable entity. And in the description of what we mean by tax-exempt property, in one instance, Section 4, we list governments, but we don't list the federal government. And in the other instance, Section 9, we list numerous governments, but we previously omitted local units of the state. So those lists are, we're adding federal to the one and local political subdivisions to the other. Section 6 has to do with the agricultural homestead classification. And I think it was 2009, we allowed small properties under 10 acres to be agricultural homesteads if the only agricultural activity is storage of grain. This change makes it clear that the grain being stored on the small parcel must have been produced by the owner of that small parcel. Section 10 has to do with the rural electrical cooperative per capita tax that's imposed in lieu of a tax on their distribution lines. Right now it has a reference to incorporated cities, and we're changing that reference to the more modern and standard phrase, statutory or home rule charter cities. Section 11 has to do with delinquent property taxes. It's a long, complicated process, part of which is to obtain a tax judgment against the parcel. This statute refers to a list and a notice. The list that is given to the court administrator for the purpose of obtaining the judgment against the parcel and then turning around and using that list as a notice to the affected owners. There's a statutory prescription on how we should describe the time you have to come in and pay those taxes and prevent your property from forfeiting. It's a long, convoluted paragraph, and it would only be made worse if we were to add the couple of weird provisions, or I shouldn't say weird, the couple of strange, unusual periods of redemption. For instance, there's a one-year period of redemption for property that used to be in a certain area near Loring Park. There's a one-year redemption period for properties that used to be solid waste disposable things. In order to get all those references into this notice, which is already long and complicated, this long and complicated part of that would have to become even more long and complicated. I don't mean to overdo it, but it is what we're proposing. Instead of trying to get the statute, again, it's kind of a long, complicated statute. We're just taking out the word-for-word prescription out of the statute and saying that the Commissioner of Revenue should help the counties give people the relevant information for their parcel in an understandable manner, which is kind of what Subdivision 2 of this statute already says. Section 13 has to do with the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program. Right now, when the person enters this program, the state takes a lien against the property for the deferred taxes. Right now, those are what you might call common law liens. They're not statutory, so we have to go through the certain procedures, which means getting them notarized, and they have to contain a certain statement down at the bottom that they were drafted by the Commissioner of Revenue. Our tax liens are well known. There's no need for the public for these things to have to be done. For us, it's an inconvenience. The person has to processing these has to go down a separate set of procedures to get them notarized, where the other liens that we do are not. So this would just provide that these liens can be produced on the same form that we use for our other tax lien. Repealer repeals the statute that hasn't been enforced since, I think, the late 60s, 272.69. It requires people who lease tangible personal property to file a list of their leased items with the commissioner each year. This hasn't been done for years, and it should be gotten rid of. The repealer also repeals the now obsolete lead paint hazard removal tax benefit. That is now obsolete. That's Article 3.
Thank you for your testimony, Mrs. Tarika. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the audience who would like to comment either in favor or opposition to Article 3? Seeing none, members, are there any questions? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't get your name, sir.
Tarika.
Tarika, Mr. Tarika. I'm looking at the revenue flyer that you have. Section 2 under the assessor's duty says you modify the list of the non-tax property appraisals that the assessor may perform. Can you give me an example of that? Are we talking about like private appraisals? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative, emphatically no. We try to... I can't do it from memory, but we try to keep assessors out of the business of appraisals for buying and selling purposes. We don't want to get into the situation where the assessor tells the person the property has one value for tax purposes and a different value if you're trying to sell it or buy it. And it's not a precise science, and there's just, we think, too much risk for that happening. But there are certain non-tax appraisals that the county assessors can do related to condemnations, acquisitions of right-of-way. And special assessments. And this would add a fourth one to that list of what they can do.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Tarika. Representative Crawford, do you have any other follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we talking about like appraisals done in the in their duty, with their duty as being assessor, or is it something that's without, you know, extraordinary to their duty?
Mr. Sharika.
Madam Chair, Representative. It's kind of yes and no. I'm trying to think of how to say that. Obviously, I think we all know the county assessor is there to value property for property tax purposes. That has become a useful figure. That has become a useful process, a useful talent for a lot of county purposes. If the county wants to acquire property for a county road, how do we get a value for that? They ask the county assessor to do that. If they, what was the other one? A condemnation, they could acquire right of way either by condemnation or purchase. In either way, it's handy for them to be able to ask the assessor, well, what do you think we should pay for that, so they don't, pay a bad price. We try to keep a limit on those kind of situations because, like I said, the theory is that appraising property is not an absolute science, and it's just too risky to have a person valuing property for two different purposes. I don't want to go on and on here, but if you want to put a value on property, if I were to loan you a certain amount of money, is the property you have worth at least that much? You could go out and do that appraisal fairly quickly, perhaps. Whereas if you wanted to get the actual true value of property, it might take a little bit more work and you might come up with a little different figure. So, long story short, we try to keep a lid on the non-property tax appraisals that the county assessors do. There are a few of them, right away, condemnation, and we're going to add this county land exchanges. So the county can get, when they're exchanging land, they can get a rough idea, some idea of what, on both sides of the equation. This is being added to that list of non-tax appraisals the county assessor can do.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain to me Section 6, what happens when that's a renter of the land? And they store that grain in the landowner's bin. How would that impact that kind of relationship and their abilities?
Mr. Sharika.
Madam Chair, Representative. That's exactly the situation this change is meant to address. This I think it was 2009 that we first allowed the storage of grain to be an ag use. All that's going on, the small parcel, less than 10 acres, all that's going on there from an ag standpoint is you're storing grain. We think that provision, when it was originally enacted in 2009, was intended for people who are storing their own grain, not the grain of somebody who has either rented their land or rented some other land. And that's what this change will accomplish.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize, I forgot your name. Mr. Sturica. So what is the definition, though, of who owns the grain? If you're the owner of the land and you're renting it to somebody who is storing it into your storage bin, when does the ownership become that of the renter rather than the owner of the land?
Mr. Sturica.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the language in the statute is operator. The grain has to be produced on land operated by the owner of the small parcel. So we're talking about an agricultural operation.
Representative Anderson.
If I could, Madam Chair.
Mr. Sturica.
All I was going to express is that with the English language, there are often choices of which words to use, and maybe a lot of times several words might not be all absolutely perfect. That's what we're using right now is the operator. The grain must have been produced by an operator who owns this land. We are certainly open to discussions on that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stryker, I had the same question as Representative Anderson. How would this impact family members who may farm with the owner of that land but may actually farm another farm? We often see a great amount of exchange of facilities and equipment between family members who may farm several different farms. Does this provide problems for that situation?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm trying to think on the fly here, but I think the best answer to that is if you have those kind of concerns, we should probably sit down and talk about the language, or maybe some of your staff could, because that's the situation that we were trying to avoid, where a renter of the land, the renter of some other land, produced grain that was stored on this land, and we didn't think this provision was enacted to cover that. It gets kind of dicey if the renter of this other land is a son or a daughter. And what we're saying here, the clear situation that we're saying here is that this mom and pop, this couple, this person who owns the small parcel must be produced with their hands and their tractor producing the grain. Once you get beyond that, if you would like it to more clearly allow for some of those other situations, we should probably talk about some additional language.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stryker. That is a very common situation out there. So we're if we don't provide some more specific language here, we're going to run in a lot of trouble. So I appreciate you and your willingness to take a look at that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Stryker. I have similar lines. I live in an area that sometimes it's a corporation, family-owned or otherwise. They own land and they rent multiple parcels of land, or they are renting land and they are a private farmer. Sometimes they store on land that they rent just because some areas are more conducive to that. Access, road access for storage and the big vehicles make a really big difference. So I have real concern with this, what I consider quite a policy change, and also have real concerns about this kind of change here that would pose real problems for my district. Mr. And maybe you might want to offer the same thing, or I just think there's several issues that are going on here that are this way more complex than just a simple technical issue.
Mr. Stryker.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I would say the same thing. If those concerns are present in the committee, we should definitely talk. Now, I don't know who we is. In order to address the concerns being brought up, we should either take the provision out of the bill or work on some additional language to satisfy everyone. And the department will just have to try to arrange that at some time.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Van Maas,
we're going through the technical bill today, and tomorrow we'll be going through the policy bill. So I would suggest that if there are provisions like this, that there are concerns, and if you want to work on the language, we would be more than happy to work with Mr. Michael, Pat Dalton, or Ms. Dalton to correct any of the language or to modify the language as would meet the needs of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Van Maas. Are there any other questions from the committee on Article 3? All right. Mr. Starowski, would you please continue with Article 4?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 4 has to do with sales and use and special taxes. The first section is a deed tax provision. For years and years and years, so-called partition deeds have been exempt from the tax, and this provision merely adds a definition to make it clear that we're only talking about deeds or a portion of a deed that conveys co-owned property. What happens is two people own property. Some of it they own together and some of it they own separately, and they want to rearrange who owns what. And just because there's some co-owned property in the deed, they try to claim the tax benefit for all the transactions occurring in the deed. And this just clarifies that the exemption is only for the co-owned property that's being conveyed either in a deed or in part of a deed.
Thank you, Mr. Starica. Continue with your testimony, please.
Section two is an insurance provision, has to do with the so-called retaliatory insurance taxes, and it's just updating some references. It's eliminating a reference to a subdivision that was repealed in 2006, and it's adding a reference to a subdivision that was added in 2005. The repealed one had to do with fire insurance premiums, and the added one has to do with life insurance. Updating some references. Section 3 has to do with two different purpose statements that were included in the tax bill last year. As I've been asked repeatedly to point out, we are not nitpicking with the purpose statement, just a term or two. We're just nitpicking with a term or two within those purpose statements. First one has to do with milling and grinding items that are used in the taconite, non-ferrous mining industry. The current law refers to these as equipment, and the sales tax people think that it's important to distinguish these that are materials consumed in production, not really equipment. The second one has to do with the purpose statement for the ticket reselling, and the nitpick here is that the purpose statement contains the word exemption when there really is an exemption. The second, as I understand it, the second reseller gets a credit for what the first reseller of the ticket paid, but there's not really per se exemption. That completes Article 4.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Starica. Are there any members of the public who would like to speak in favor or have concerns about this Article Number 4? Are there any members that have any questions? Seeing no questions, we'll proceed to Article 5.
Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
Stephen Krenkel. I'm testifying on Article 5, which is cleanup technical language. There are substantial amendments made to the net proceeds tax, which is the mining taxes imposed on non-iron mining, non-ferrous operations. The amendments were made in the special session last year. The first section deletes an exemption for direct reduced ore from the net proceeds exemptions. Direct reduced ore is an iron mining term. The exemption continues, and the iron mining exemptions in Section 298.25. This simply deletes that reference in a non-ferrous situation. Direct reduced ore is not non-ferrous product. The second section defines hydrometallurgical processes. As a new term that was used in the statute, it was not defined using general definitions that were found in consultation with our minerals office. We came up with this definition to supply a definition that was not included in the amendments last year. The third section deletes out the reference to energy resources and includes ores and metals in the distribution sections. That basically, that does put the distribution section terminology in line with the imposition of the tax section. So you're using the same term on the imposition of the tax and the distribution of the tax. So it's cleanup from last year, technical in nature.
Thank you, Mr. Krenkel, for your comments. Are there any members of the audience that would like to speak in favor or have concerns regarding this article, Article 5? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Where's the question? Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Krinkle, is it?
That's correct.
As in Chris with a hard G, huh? But anyway.
That's been said before.
Mr. Krinkle, I wasn't here, members, during the special session, and I had the House bill that put all this language in, and I didn't support it. And, of course, I had just gotten out of the hospital with a new knee when the governor called a special session. So I didn't see what happened, and I heard about it, and I didn't like it. But let me ask you this question. You know, this is the net proceeds tax, Mr. Chair, which we've discussed in here, which is then the local property tax in lieu of. And so I'm going to ask the revenue department, if you can't, if everything is exempt, all these are exempt under the net proceeds tax, or am I reading this wrong? If you can't tax the deposits of ore, or the deposits of metals, or the deposits of minerals, or the land on which they're contained, or all real property and all personal property used in mining, and you can't tax the concentrate, can somebody tell me what the hell's left to tax? Please. What's left to tax? I don't understand this language, and I was concerned about it last year, and so I have no idea what's there left to tax.
Excuse me, Madam
Chair. Mr. Krinkle.
Are you referring to the amendments from last year?
I'm referring to the whole section from last year, which is Minnesota Statutes 2011 supplement, and all of this went into law, I assume. And if the committee wants to read it, property used in business of mining is subject to net proceeds tax, but the following property used in the business of mining is subject to net proceeds tax is exempt. So if the ore is exempt, the metals exempt, the minerals are exempt, the land's exempt, the real and personal property used to mine all of it is exempt, and the concentrate, which we're having an issue right now in taconite mining, which one guy has proposed to send to a plant outside the state to make pellets, I want to know what's the Department of Revenue interpreting is left to tax.
Mr. Michael, will you make a comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, the Section 1 is the exemption under the real property tax for this property. And so essentially what it's saying is that because these mining operations will pay the net proceeds tax based on essentially a sort of a hybrid profit measure, they're not. This property will not be subject to property tax. So last year this was put in just, there was not in the statute a clear statement that the non-ferrous mining operations were not subject to property tax, and so this just makes it clear that they don't pay both the property tax and the net proceeds tax. And the department now is just trying to get a sort of iron ore taconite term out of that definition in their proposed change.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, and I understand it, Mr. Michaels, but like I said, last year when I looked at this language, I had concerns about it, and then it went in the full bill, and we were exempting things before we even ever get a copper nickel mine ever permitted in this state. But I'm just wondering if all of this is exempt from a personal, any kind of property taxes, the net proceeds tax, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Michaels, is in lieu of a property tax, is it not?
Right. Mr. Michael.
It is.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, yes, it is.
So if we exempt all of this, what's left to tax?
They get this exemption because they're paying the net proceeds tax. And they essentially,
on what?
If you read the language on line 48.32, it says, the property used in the business of mining that is subject to the net proceeds tax is exempt. So essentially, if it's not paying the net proceeds tax, it wouldn't be exempt. So it's sort of an either or proposition. They don't pay the property tax because they're paying the net proceeds tax.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, and for the Department of Revenue, because this is all new to all of us and to Mr. Michaels, you know, it's hard enough to explain taconite taxes to this committee, and now I can't follow this. Which is going to be in lieu of local property tax for copper nickel, because what you're telling me then is once the concentrate is shipped,
to wherever they're going to refine it further, there will be some type of formula, like there used to be for the old ad valorem tax, that will determine the market rate of copper and nickel and gold and silver. Then they'll come back and pay us? Because right now, I don't understand, there's nothing left to tax under this language. So I don't know what we're paying the net proceeds tax then on. But maybe I need a lobbyist to explain it to me or something.
Mr. Michael?
Because the lobbyist put this in the bill, and I didn't support it, members.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure whether the confusion is arising because of the potential for mining ore in Minnesota and shipping it out of state to, you know, go through the beneficiation process. Is that...
That's my question.
I'll have to go back and look at the net proceeds tax, but it's triggered by the mining, I believe, and if we had to, it is based on the assumption that both of those activities occur in Minnesota. I'm not sure if we have to face the issue of that going on, how that tax would be apportioned, and whether or not it would still apply in full to the essentially the profits from that operation, or whether it would only apply to part of the profits from that operation.
Here's my dilemma, committee members, and to the Department of Revenue. You know, I mean, we have some of the largest deposits of copper in the world. Some are saying the second largest deposit of copper, and perhaps the biggest deposit of nickel. And then we've got all these other precious metals. But because of our proximity to the Boundary Waters and the Voyageurs National Park, we run into haze issues and air issues and water issues, and the Great Lakes is there, watershed. So I don't think any refining, which was proposed by the PolyMet project, which is the first one out there after 6 years of trying and proposing and revamping things, still hasn't got even a draft EIS out the door. Now they've downsized. They were going to make sheets of copper, which would probably be easy to tax, but because of all these other standards, because we live in the wilderness, you know, they burn down the woods, and you guys wouldn't let them burn down your woods, but they burned down ours this summer in a flash fire. But anyway, I'm digressing. But now they backed off on making the sheet copper because it puts them into a higher air quality thing. So I don't think anything's going to be refined here. So how do we, what are we taxing? It's all going to be concentrate, and it's going to go somewhere else, probably to Canada by Thunder Bay, to get refined and turned into a workable copper, nickel, zinc, whatever we got up there, solution. How are we going to track that? How are we going to do that? In this language, I don't understand.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Rukavina. Do you have any comments, Mr. Krenkel?
No, I don't have any comments at all. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from members?
Well, Madam Chair?
Okay.
Could somebody kind of answer my question about what's left to tax? Well, I guess I have to have this
Mr.
conversation,
Michael?
Madam Chair, with Mr. Michael and maybe the tax chair, because I'm not tracking how, if this wealth is ever pulled out of the ground, and it will be a considerable amount of wealth, how we're going to extract any taxes on the local level. I mean, the occupation tax is spelled out pretty good in law there, but I don't know how we're getting local property taxes.
All right, we will continue with testimony from the department, Article 6. Please state your name for the record.
Cecilia Morrow, I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. In Article 6, Section 1, the first section relates to state warrants in general. It's included in the department's technical bill as it affects the Department of Revenue, but the issue is also relevant to all state agencies that issue warrants. Thus, the department is advancing the proposal on behalf of the department as well as MMB. Section 1 amends Section 16.46 of the statutes to clarify the consequences of a warrant being canceled and made void by simply spelling out that when a duplicate state warrant has had to be issued, that the original warrant, which is specified as void under the statute, means that any holder of the void warrant is not able to recover on the warrant as against the state. It's the way the law has been for a very long time. This is just simply to make it absolutely clear by specification in that statute. Then in Article 6, Sections 2 through 12 is a Department of Revenue proposal. This section of the bill amend the statutes that direct how interest on penalties is calculated in order to make simplification and the uniformity of the statutes improved. Each of the statutes that affect it is amended to provide and direct the reader to the provision in the General Tax Administration Chapter 270C to provide that interest runs under the statutes in the general statute, that interest runs from the date a penalty is assessable until it is paid. There is a variety of places throughout the statutes over the years that have stated the rule for interest on penalties. This makes that a single uniform statement and drives everyone's attention to that single uniform statement. And that concludes Article 6.
And that is the conclusion of the entire bill?
Correct.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, Ms. Moreau. Are there any comments or from the audience, either in favor of this bill or this article, or with concerns? We will close the public portion of this hearing. And are there any comments or questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, I renew the motion to have House File 2690 laid over for possible inclusion in technical omnibus tax bill. If there are no other questions from members, we will adjourn. Seeing none.